Hi. Thanks so much for having me. Man, the guy in that introduction sounds really impressive, and you just get me. So I apologize for that. But before I start, I guess there's just a couple of things that I want to say. First of all, one of the things that you just heard in my biography is that I have a master's degree in theology from the Franciscan University of Steubenville. I did my undergraduate there as well, and having spent a lot of time in Steubenville, I have seen with regularity things that might seem strange to others. You know, I have seen people sort of be prayed over and then fall spontaneously onto the floor. I have heard entire lectures given in the unknown languages of tongues. I practically minored in tongues. You have to assume, in fact. But what I have never seen until today, and today I came to Lander, Wyoming, and I saw something which I have never seen in the church and which I don't expect to see in the church again unless you guys invite me back, which is I just saw like an entire room of grown-ups recite beautiful poems together and on command with enthusiasm. And so I said to my friend Bishop Conley the other day, you heard that I work for Bishop Conley, and he's a good friend of our families, and he loves this place, as many bishops do. And I said to my friend Bishop Conley the other day, I'm going to Wyoming Catholic College. What should I tell them? And he said, he thought about it for a minute, and he said sagely, tell them that faith without poetry is dead. But I don't have to tell you that, because you just did the stomping thing for the meaning of two minds. So your faith is alive. It was a beautiful thing to see. It was extraordinarily encouraging. And again, I went to Steubenville, and I think it was unusual. So it was unusual, and I think it is important. I think it is important that you know that. But it's really great to be here. I spent the entire day in Lander because there's like one flight in the middle of the night to get here, and one flight in the early morning hours to go home. So if you come for a lecture, you get to spend a lot of time in Lander, which is actually quite cool. I had the chance to go to Mass with some of you today. I had the chance to kind of interrupt a class. I had the chance to visit CORE and learn about like your 21-day forced march through the backwoods before you get, and you pay, as I understand it, you pay money to do this forced march, which is an extraordinary thing. But I also I got to have dinner with Dr. Arbery, and he didn't say this explicitly, but we had a kind of a kismet, a kind of a chemistry, and my sense was that Dr. Arbery wanted to give me an honorary doctorate from Wyoming Catholic College. And I just want to say that I accept. Like, thank you. And so, we have a canonical maxim that silence equals consent. And so, barring you revoking my honorary doctorate, I'm going to keep it. I just thank you. See, there you have it. So, which I think also allows me to sort of tell war stories about my forced march, my honorary march through the backwoods of Wyoming. And I'm very proud of that as well. I learned a lot. Learned a lot about myself out there. That's good. I really am very grateful to be here. This is a beautiful place, and it's a special place. And the message that I want to give to you tonight is effectively a message of encouragement. I also want to preface, these are going into the prepared marks, but telling more jokes. I want to preface my kind of remarks with a kind of a caveat, because I did get a chance to sit in on a class today, and I did get a chance to kind of review the curriculum that you study here, and I've gotten a chance to talk with many of your teachers. And I feel that I should just clarify that I am not an intellectual. I did my undergrad was the honors program at the Franciscan University of Steubenville. I'm not going to make a couple of jokes there, but my undergraduate was the honors program at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, which is a kind of a great books or good books program, which means that I was assigned many of the books that you have read, but I want to make a distinction between was assigned and have read, and be clear that you know things that are in those books. And what I did is sort of like walk up to class with a smart kid and say, what do you think of the readings, you know, and then listen to what they say. But a big part of being a journalist is asking questions, and I started that by saying, so just if you were to summarize in about, you know, 5 minutes what you got out of the readings, what'd you get? And then I'd steal that from them as soon as the seminar started. And I don't know if anybody has that strategy, but it'll get you by, maybe, I don't know. But I do feel like I should preface that I'm not an intellectual, and this will not be a kind of intellectual lecture. I am, by training, a canon lawyer, and by profession, a journalist, and I have the great privilege to work as a journalist in the life of the church, to cover the life of the church and the lives of believers around the world. And for me, that is an extraordinary gift, because most of what it means is that I get to talk with people who are doing important and interesting things for the kingdom, in the proclamation of the gospel, in the life of faith, in the care of widows and orphans, and I get to ask them questions about it, and they tell me things. And so I have the gift of seeing holiness firsthand and often. And I want to talk about that a little bit tonight. But I want to preface that. Before I sort of talk about that, I want to talk, the title of this talk is something like The State of the Church, It's Not What You Think It Is, or something like that. And the reason, is that what it is? Okay. I don't know. They don't put the name of the talk on the check, so I haven't read what it is yet. I'm just kidding. I didn't get the check, because what if I curse up here and they've already paid me? You know, they have to be able to pull it. The title of this talk is Why the State of the Church Isn't What You Here It Is, or something like that. And the reason for that is because I travel around in the life of the church a lot, and I talk with Catholics very often who are deeply involved in the life of the church or who care very much about the life of the church, as all of you do. And the consensus that I hear more and more often, or the questions that people ask me more and more often, there's a sense that many people have, I think, in this country, many Catholics who care about the life of the church. There's a kind of something which I have experienced, or which I intuit, or which people tell me about. I'm just aware of a kind of growing sense among many Catholics who care about the life of the church of a kind of anxiety about the state of the church, a kind of concern for the welfare of the church, for her present life, and for her future. And I think this is multi-pronged, and I'll tell you about some of the things that I tend to hear about, because I think it's important to acknowledge the sort of anxiety about them and also their reality. And in fact, it seems to me in a certain way that you who come to Wyoming Catholic College have in a certain way implicitly acknowledged that some of these things exist. You have come by choice to Lander, Wyoming. There's like, you have to work really hard to get to Lander, Wyoming, I have found. And you have come by choice to Lander, Wyoming because you want, or maybe your parents want, I don't know, you should talk to them about that. But you want, let's just say, a particular kind of formation in the Catholic Church. You want to be formed from the riches of from the riches of the gospel, from the riches of the church's intellectual tradition. You want to be formed in the church's mode of worshiping and living and being together. You want to be formed in the riches of Christian culture. And all of you, I think, know that the reason why you had to come to all the way to Lander, Wyoming, unless you're from here, but the reason why most of you came to Lander, Wyoming for that purpose is because that kind of formation isn't available in very many places in the life of the church. That what happens here is, in a certain way, quite unique and quite special. But what's interesting about that is it's unique and special in this moment in time, and in another way, it's a very ordinary way of being in the life of the church. I think all of us have the sense that the kind of formation you're getting here is what we would hope that most Catholics would get as they're formed for a life of discipleship. That the gifts that you're given of the riches of the church's intellectual tradition and the church's liturgical tradition and the church's culture itself, the culture of what it means to be a Catholic, that what you get here should be an ordinary expression of the Christian life. And would that every parish in America have the kind of culture that you have, the rich, thick Catholic culture that you have here, such that would that every parish in America, you know, the DRE, I guess, would be able to come up here and stomp and you all start saying poetry? I mean, all of you know, right? You don't want to know what happens when the DRE stomps at most parishes, the kind of stuff that they... All of you, I think, know that what you're getting here is both like what Christians ought to be getting and that there's something unique and special about the fact that you're getting it here. There is, if nothing else, a kind of lacuna in ordinary Christian formation in many parts of the life of the church, and that's evidenced, I think, by the fact that people come from all over the country and possibly all over the world, I don't know, but possibly all over the world to get that kind of formation here at Wyoming Catholic College. You've sought it out. And the very fact that you have to seek it out tells us that this vast repository of the church's treasures, intellectual, spiritual, liturgical, cultural, are not available in all places at all times. And so there's this sort of demonstration by the very existence of Wyoming Catholic College that I think all of you can recognize. There's something that we're missing right now. And if that's the sort of broad spectrum of a sense in which people have a kind of anxiety about the present state of the life of the church, and in which sort of people tend to kind of wonder, where is this thing that is the fullness of Catholic culture, and how can we more richly experience it in our communities? In recent years, I think anxiety about the life of the church has become more acute for a lot of Catholics. I would say in my observation working in the life of the church, in the last 10 years, perhaps, anxiety about the life of the church in many ways has become more acute. And for a lot of American Catholics, all the more over the past, let's say, 5 years. I think certainly for a lot of Catholics, the scandals regarding sort of clerical misconduct and clerical abuse of office and clerical sexual immorality, which were precipitated with the McCarrick scandals, sort of opened their eyes to a set of concerns that they may have thought were in the past. You know, I think a lot of Catholics sort of thought, there was this story of terrible things that happened in the life of the Church, which Dante memorialized, but which we fixed in 2002 with something called the Dallas Charter. And now we don't have it anymore. And then in 2018 we had to confront, no, indeed, we still have these problems. There's perhaps no escape from the dilemmas of these problems, and they crop up in the Church over and over again. The challenge of clerics whose sexuality isn't well integrated into their life of faith and ministry. And so I think for a lot of people, that anxiety sort of was produced about that. And at the same time, for a lot of people, there has been anxiety about the theological trajectory of the life of the Church. Catholics who sort of pay attention to these things have raised questions about, you know, the promulgation of Amoris Laetitia, sort of controversial theological articulation of the Church's teaching regarding faith, regarding marriage and the family, and some of the most intimate parts of marital life. I think for a lot of people there has been anxiety surrounding kind of the programmatic approach of the so-called synod on synodality of the Vatican, in which there's this sort of global consultative process, which a lot of people are concerned kind of veils a theological agenda which would undermine the Church's commitment to objective moral truth. And I think for a lot of people there's anxiety even about the kind of administration and governance of justice in the life of the Church. So I talk with people who say it seems that there's a sort of crisis in the Church's efforts even to reform herself. That in 2018, the Church made a pledge to kind of reform herself with accountability and transparency. And some of those things, some of those legal mechanisms which were promised for the sake of reform and integrity and the Church's faithful and integral commitment to the mission of the gospel seem to be applied selectively or, you know, almost politically, such that there seems to be a crisis of morale and confidence and justice itself, the virtue of justice itself, in the life of the Church. There was a study that came out that was published earlier this year from the Catholic University of America, which kind of illustrates what I'm talking about. It was a study of Catholic priests and bishops across the United States. And priests were asked questions like, do you trust your bishop? And bishops were asked questions like, do you think your priest trusts you? Bishop, do you think your priest trusts you? Oh, sure, yes, absolutely. I think that my priest probably trusts me and think that I'm a good guy. Priest, do you trust your bishop? No! We don't. Bishops, do you think priests could come to you with their problems and talk with you about their problems and get pastoral and fatherly counsel from you? Yeah, I think that my priest would be able to come to me and I'm kind of available to them and, you know, I would be a good listener and stuff like that. Priest, do you think that your bishops would be a good listener and you could come to them with their problems? No, are you going to tell our bishops our problems? That will get us in trouble. There was this profound discordance between the perspective of priests in the life of the Church and the perspective of bishops on the life of the Church with regard to this sort of intimate paternal relationship of bishop to priest. And I think that reflects a genuine crisis in the Church with regard to sort of her just governance, which needs to be addressed and which needs to be reformed. A lot of my own work in the life of the Church as a journalist is to raise issues in areas in which the Church remains sort of in need of ongoing reform with regard to the administration of justice. But when I talk to Catholics across the country, these kinds of things are sources of real and profound anxiety for them, and understandably so. The Synod on Synodality, Amoris Laetitia, this survey, the Synodal Path, I mentioned the Synodal Path. I've noticed a kind of very interesting thing which has happened in recent months that pertains to the survey of priests and bishops. When I go somewhere and I'm talking to a group of priests, they very often quickly bring up this survey, you know, about whether priests trust their bishops. They want to talk about it, and what can our bishops do so that we can trust them more, and how can we reform this, and our bishops need to be paying attention to this. This is a topic on the mind of a lot of priests. If you kind of go and have drinks with priests, which is a fun thing to do because they usually have good booze, this is the thing that they want to talk about. If you go and you then have conversations with their bishops, they sit down and you say, Bishop, how are you doing? And they say, well, we got a lot of problems in the life of the Church. And you say, you ain't kidding. And they say, yeah, what are we going to do about Germany? They have a completely sort of different set of perceptions about which are the problems in the life of the Church. And that in itself reflects a kind of discordance. And so between these things, a sort of theological crisis which perhaps began with a sort of unpacking of the First Vatican Council and has continued to today, right? I think in a certain way the theological crisis of today is a crisis which began with our interpretation of Vatican I and which we're still trying to interpret and understand and authentically integrate into the life of the Church. Between this sort of theological crisis which is manifesting in things like the Synod on Synodality and the crisis of clerical sexual misconduct which arose with the McCarrick scandal, and this question about priests trusting their bishops, and things like the synod on synodality, and then COVID, where for a lot of Catholics there was a sense of having been betrayed or having been abandoned or having been forgotten by their bishops because churches closed and sacraments became unavailable. There is a sense, I think, among a lot of Catholics that all of these things are a unique and particular crisis in the life of the church, that all of these things amount to a kind of something sort of epical, right? That we have reached some kind of very serious omega point for the life of the church, and that this needs to be attended to. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that the crises which are sort of delineated there are real. That there is a real crisis which pertains to the administration of governance in the life of the church. That there is a real crisis of theological reflection in the life of the church and the way the church exercises the munus docendi. That there was a sense of mistrust which was which developed during COVID and which has sort of been exacerbated by various things after that. That those things which arise are real. But the problem, I think, is that for a lot of Catholics, that's kind of the end of the story. The church is in crisis. The church is on her last legs. The church is in a state of cataclysm. And we have to sort of go deep into a bunker and kind of wait it out for some future time when the church will be better and richer and stronger, or when there will be some sort of new revival of the of Christian discipleship. And I hear that all the time. Maybe you hear it too. But I'd like to suggest that that's a short-sighted perspective in two ways. First of all, it's a short-sighted perspective on the life of the church right now, today. And second of all, it's a short-sighted perspective on the nature of the church across history. So what do I mean by that? As I said, I have a kind of cool opportunity to talk to Catholics all around the world. And if you're a Catholic in the United States and you kind of read Catholic online news, obviously not my own website, but other Catholic online news websites, you can get a sense that these things which are happening in the Vatican, these theological debates which are happening, these questions of integrity which are happening, are the only things that are happening in the life of the church. That the story of the church right now is a series of theological disagreements and political infighting and abandonment of of Catholic doctrine or abandonment of the lay people during COVID. You can get a sense that these are the only things that are happening in the church right now. And the reason for that is because we have right now, I think, a unique front row seat to many of these things which are unfolding in the Vatican. And that's the voice which is most often amplified kind of in Catholic media, or even in sort of secular media commentary about the Catholic Church. If you read kind of the coverage of the Catholic Church in the Wall Street Journal, the kinds of things they cover are the political infighting and machinations of cardinals between each other in preparation for the Synod on Synodality. And understandably so. People click on that stuff, and when people click on that stuff, you make money. So it's sort of understandable that that is the stuff which we see most often. But it's a mistake, I think, to imagine that that having a front row seat to the stuff that's happening in Rome means that the stuff that's happening in Rome is the most important stuff that's happening in the life of the church today. I talk to people all around the world, which is what I said a minute ago, but I do, and as a consequence of that, I have sort of been able to build friendships with people who are experiencing a very different ecclesial reality than that myopic focus on sort of Vatican politics or intrigue would suggest is the story of the church. In January, I talked with a priest from a northern state in Nigeria. Father is from Nigeria. Father's from Igbo land in the south of Nigeria. Father's like, yes, I am. Why are you talking to me? Father is from Igbo land. Father's awesome, by the way. You guys are really gifted to have this guy. I had a great chance to talk with him today. But Father's from Igbo land in the south of Nigeria. In January, I talked with a priest. January 16th, I talked with a priest who lives in the northern part of Nigeria. He's a parochial vicar, an assistant priest at a parish in the northern part of Nigeria. And I talked with him on the phone from his hospital bed. He was in a hospital. The reason he was in a hospital is because he had several gunshot wounds. The night before, he had gone to bed, as on any other night, and he woke up in his rectory bedroom. His rectory was a kind of a compound at a parish in northern Nigeria. He woke up with guns in his face. His region is the epicenter of the sort of Boko Haram terrorist movement, which has terrorized Christians across Northwest Africa. He woke up with guns in his face. The gunmen, who were sort of holding their guns aloft and shouting at him and shouting sort of Boko Haram slogans, demanded to be taken to the pastor. They had an issue with the pastor because the pastor, they believed, was proselytizing the Islamic community in their area, that he was preaching the gospel to the Islamic community in the area, and they wanted to make an example of him. They said he represented a threat to their influence in the region. And so they demanded that they be taken to the pastor. And at first he refused. He said, no, I'm not going to take you anywhere. And they put guns in his face and they marched him outside and they demanded that they be taken to the pastor. And the pastor, hearing a kind of a commotion in the courtyard, turned on his light, and so they saw which of the buildings, outbuildings of the compound was his, and they all marched over there together. And they put this priest on the ground, and they put the pastor, his name was Father Azagaki, on the ground. And they shouted at them for a while, and it wasn't clear what they wanted. They were talking on the phone for a while. They were urging them to recant what they said was their violence against against Islamic people, their proselytism against Islamic people, wanting them at one point to recant Christ. And these two priests sat on the ground while gunmen were waving their guns around them while they didn't know what would happen in their lives. And they started to pray together. They prayed the rosary together, sitting on the ground of their rectory while there were 15 gunmen in their compound. Well, 15 gunmen shot their guns into the air and shouted Islamic slogans and told them that if they didn't renounce Jesus Christ, they would die. After they prayed the rosary together, they heard each other's confessions. They heard each other's confessions because they knew what was going to happen next. The parochial vicar, whose name is Father Cletus, started sort of making a distraction and started talking to these guys and told them that they needed to release him and that the police were going to be coming and that the villagers were going to see what was happening and call the police and they needed to leave right away. And they turned around and somebody shot him in the hand. And they shot Father Azagaki in the leg, right in the thigh. His thigh bone was shattered. He laid there, bleeding on the floor, continuing to pray, holding each other's hands, praying, saying the Psalms together, calling to the Blessed Mother, praying memoraries together, the name of Jesus on their lips. When the gunmen were distracted, Father Isaac, the pastor, told his parochial vicar to jump through the window and to get help. The parochial vicar didn't want to. He wanted to stay with his pastor. But Father Isaac said, no, you have to go. You have to get help because I'm worried that they're going to destroy the church. Father Isaac was concerned, not for himself. Father Isaac was concerned that these gunmen were going to defile the Blessed Sacrament in the tabernacle of the church. And he wanted his parochial vicar to run and go get help, not so that Father Isaac would be spared, but so that the church, the sanctity of the church and the integrity of the Blessed Sacrament, the place where the people came to worship God, would be preserved, so that he might get help. The parochial vicar jumps out the window. He starts to run. The gunmen see him. They shoot at him, but as it happens, they're not very good shots. They obviously didn't go to Wyoming Catholic College. as it happens, they're not very good shots, so he gets shot several times, but not fatally. He runs through the village and he urges the people to get help. But as he's running across the compound to get help, he hears some more gunshots. Father Azagaki is shot in the chest several times. He lays there on the floor, and as he's lying there on the floor, the men begin to pour gasoline around the compound. They light the rectory on fire. They light the church on fire. The entire thing goes up in flames. Father Azagaki, it's believed, didn't suffer the fire. It's believed that he died before the fire would have gotten to his body, but he died with the name of Jesus on his lips. He died praying the scripture. He died calling to the Blessed Mother. He died a martyr on January 15th, 2023. Not in the 4th century, not in the Colosseum of Rome, not centuries ago. He died on January 15th, 2023, a martyr for Jesus Christ. Guys, that's the story that matters in the life of the church today. Tertullian says that the blood of the martyrs is the seabed of Christianity, right? That the extraordinary spread of Christianity across the West began with the spiritual sacrifice of the martyrs. St. Ignatius, who says that he wants to be ground like wheat in the lion's teeth so that he can be an act of thanksgiving to the Lord. The martyrdoms of the early church, we know, were responsible for the extraordinary spiritual flourishing of the church in the centuries which came after. So if you want to know the powerful story of the church today, it's not the kind of administrative crisis or the kind of moral crisis which has plagued the church in every century. It's the extraordinary gift of a martyr praying dying with the name of Jesus on his lips, praying for his people. One of the stories that I've had the opportunity to cover over the past couple of months, maybe the past 6 months or 7 months, is the story of the church, the persecuted church in Nicaragua. I don't know if you guys follow very much about, if you guys follow Nicaraguan politics very closely, if you have spare time from reading Plato or what have you, maybe you just hit it. I don't know if you follow Nicaraguan politics very closely, but Nicaragua is ruled by a dictator who would say, because he wants you to think that he has ideological principles, a dictator who would say sometimes that he's a socialist and sometimes that he's a communist, but what he means is he spouts off ideological slogans that pertain to something having to do with the common welfare of the people and the common enrichment of the people while he's lining his pockets. A dictator named Daniel Ortega, whose principal philosophical commitment is his own enrichment and that of his family. Ortega's the dictator, his kids and his in-laws run all of the public utilities in the country. It's a pretty good racket. And in order to maintain their power in Nicaragua, they do the things that thuggish dictators have to do. They suppress free speech, they suppress free thought, they suppress free communication, and they communicate constantly a message of indignity to the people of Nicaragua. You would be nothing without us. You have much more than you think you have. You think you're poor, but you're not. You think you're sick, but you're not. You think you're being taken advantage of, but you're not. Were it not for us, how you would be suffering. Look at the poor in a place like America. Look at the poor in a place like America, which has extraordinary richness, but also extraordinary poverty. Without us, all of you would experience that extraordinary poverty, which actually their poverty is far worse. Look at the poor in favelas and slums around the world. They're poorer than the people in our favelas and slums. Were it not for us, you would be suffering so much more. You would have no dignity, no worth, no value. You would be the forgotten people of a forgotten Central American country were it not for us and our greatness. This is the message communicated to those people. Not a message that sounds something like, you have inestimable dignity because you're made in the image and likeness of God. You who are baptized into the person of Jesus Christ are called to divine intimacy with God the Father, Almighty Creator of all things. Not a message like that. But a message like that is a threat to the message of the thuggish dictators of Nicaragua. And so the church is a threat to the thuggish dictators of Nicaragua. And as a consequence of that, the church has suffered profoundly. The missionaries of charity were expelled from Nicaragua a couple of months ago. Could you imagine kicking the missionaries of charity out of your country? Right? But their witness of extraordinary commitment to the poor, their witness to the notion that the poor have dignity, that it's worth spending time on cleaning the wounds of the indigent and the sick, runs contrary to precisely what a thuggish dictatorship would want us to believe about ourselves. Right? So they kick the missionaries of charity out. They kick priests out. They kick other religious sisters out. They kick the apostolic nuncio out because they're concerned that Rome might feel incentivized to say something unless they sort of make a flex of power. And so they even kick sort of the Pope's emissary out of the country. And who are left are the priests and bishops and lay people and some of the religious sisters of the country of Nicaragua. Some of them, terrified by the regime, say very little. Some of them, terrified by the regime, say exactly what the regime wants them to say. But some of them have the courage to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. One of the ways they do that is through the network of radio. So there's not a lot of 5G in the mountains of Nicaragua or the jungles for that matter. And so people don't, it's a little bit like Wyoming Catholic College actually, because people are not looking at their phones all that much. So I guess you guys kind of know what it's like. Maybe you listen to the radio too. But in Nicaragua, they listen to the radio all the time because, they're not looking at their phones. They don't know how to crush candy or anything. So the radio is still an extraordinarily powerful mechanism of communication, and the church has owned the most powerful radio network in Nicaragua, which is not sort of one gigantic broadcast of a message, but lots of little stations. Every rectory practically has a little radio station where the mass is broadcast, where the rosary is broadcast, where some news is read from a newspaper so people have some idea what's actually going on, where there's a reminder, you are made in the image and likeness of God. You are called to divine intimacy with the Father and Creator of all things. The Ortega administration can't stand it. And so last year they decided that they'd had enough with Catholic radio in the country, and they ordered the destruction of Catholic radio stations everywhere. They said that they were unlicensed. And it wasn't that they were Catholic that they had to destroy them, but it's that they didn't fill out the proper paperwork to get the licenses. And so the bishop said, oh, that's funny, because we keep going down to the license office to get the licenses, and you say that you're out of the applications, and so we really haven't been able to apply for them. And they say, well, that's not our fault, it's yours, you should have gotten them. So they get into this silly fight about that, and the administration determines that they're going to close down all the radio stations, and so they start storming rectories all over the country. And break the radio equipment and storm out. It's, you know, thuggish jackboot radio destruction everywhere. But there's one parish in the Nicaraguan mountains where the pastor says, no, I'm not going to surrender my radio station. He tells the people on the radio, they're coming to destroy this, and I think this is important, and I think you should think it's important too, so we should stand up for this. So when the police come, the federal police come to destroy and confiscate the radio equipment, the people stand outside with the message that if you're coming to destroy it, you have to come through us. The police don't want an international incident. They don't want, you know, video footage of them sort of mowing through a bunch of the Nicaraguan peasants and farmers who they claim to represent. And so this standoff ensues with the priest and a few people inside with the radio equipment and lots of people outside. And for several days, this standoff is kind of this dead standoff. The police surrounding them with their guns, the people praying and holding hands and praying the rosary, and the priest inside continuing to broadcast on the radio. The police cut off the electricity, they cut off the water, there's not that much food in the rectory, people get hungry. Eventually the police feel they've warned them. Oh, at night, this is super interesting. At night, to keep them from going to sleep, they play very loudly American pop music into the rectory. And could you imagine trying to sleep with Cardi B just beating through every single fiber of your being? I don't know a Cardi B song, and I don't even know if that's a cool and current hip reference, but maybe you guys don't either, I don't know. So anyway, could you imagine this sort of thing? So this is how it's going, and eventually the police decide, okay, we've worn them down enough, and they go in and they aim to destroy the radio equipment, and they confiscate it, and they arrest the priest. And the bishop of that diocese speaks out. Bishop Alvarez, he speaks out. He says, this was wrong. And he tells the priests of his diocese that they're going to come together and they're going to have a mass to pray for their country, to pray for the people and the leaders of their country, to pray for peace in their country. But the government doesn't like that. So when Bishop Alvarez tries to leave his house, right after the radio has been destroyed, the police won't let him leave. He says, am I under arrest? They say, no, you're not under arrest. You just can't leave the house. And he says, oh, so I'm under house arrest. And they say, no, you're not under house arrest. You just can't leave the house. Oh, all right. So Bishop Alvarez and a couple of priests and a couple of seminarians are locked inside the house for at first, they think it's going to be a couple days. People gather, international media gathers, people covered. I have this heroic correspondent. He lives in Venezuela, which means he's got his own problems. But he's this heroic correspondent who begins to write about this stuff and cover it and talk to people who are there. And, you know, he faces his own risk of persecution from doing so, but he thinks it's so important that you guys and us and all of us in the United States know what's happening, that he starts to write about it along with all kinds of other journalists. He starts to say the bishop is under house arrest, right? So a couple of days go by. Again, there's not that much food. The police cut off electricity, but this is an example of phones being used for good. The police cut off electricity, but from inside the house, the bishop tells everybody to sort of like compile their phones, put them all together, and then turn off all the phones except for one. And with that phone, they start live streaming the celebration of the Mass from inside the house. They use Facebook Live. Facebook is a social media app. Perhaps you've heard of it. They use... Not if Wyoming Catholic College had anything to do with it. Just... I'm totally kidding. Please don't take back that doctorate, and please don't take back that check. Okay. So first phone, they start live streaming the Mass. They start live streaming the rosary. They have these praise and worship sessions, which they're singing songs, and they have guitars. Again, perhaps you've heard of it. They're singing songs, and they have guitars, this whole thing. And every day, Bishop Alvarez goes to the front door, and he sings this kind of goofy Nicaraguan pop song about two friends who are sort of spending the day together to the policeman who's guarding the door. He taunts him, right? He taunts him with charity in this stupid song. So they do this in the first day and the second day, and when that phone dies, they do it with the next phone, and they do it with the next. They continue to live stream from in the house the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, the Most Holy Rosary, their praise to God, morning prayer, evening prayer. It's a message of commitment to the gospel and a message of defiance to those who would say you don't have dignity, you're not made in the image and likeness of God, you would be nothing without our thuggish dictatorship, day after day after day. They stay in the house for 2 weeks. By the end, they didn't have very much to eat. Worse than that, they were getting on each other's nerves. At the end, the police come in. They take Bishop Alvarez to a house in Managua, the capital of Nicaragua, and they tell him, okay, now you're under house arrest. That was just, you know, you didn't choose to leave. They put him under house arrest. They take everybody else to this horrific prison called El Chapote, where torture takes place. It's a torture center. And they tell some of them, they take one guy into a room, and they tell him, listen, your mother is very sick. And if you recant your commitment to Bishop Alvarez and the gospel, we'll get your mom the best medical treatment that we can get. And look, this is Nicaragua. We get it. We'll get your mom treatment in America even. Like, we will do what we can, the top of the line for your mom. But it's up to you. You recant. you deny the gospel, you deny your commitment to the life of the church, and everything is taken care of. He didn't do it. To another guy, they bring him in, and this guy is resilient and mouthy and angry, so they just beat him. They tell him the beatings will stop when you recant. He doesn't do it. We talked later with one of these guys, and he told us that the food is obviously terrible because it's a Nicaraguan prison. One star on Yelp, the whole deal. But the food is obviously terrible. This is a Nicaraguan prison, but at one point they give them these baked goods. Well, they got, I guess Nicaraguan dictatorships get their cues from like bad John Hughes 80s movies, because they put X-lax in the baked goods, right? And then they take them in for interrogations, and these guys have stomachs which are bursting. They've been given laxatives, and they tell them, if you recant, you can use the bathroom. But if you don't recant, you're going back to you're going to stay here and soil yourself, and then you're going back to your cell where you don't really have a shower or a laundry or a mechanism, so you think about how long you want to sit in your own filth. Or you recant the gospel. And of course, some of them do have to sit in their own filth. Some of them do suffer beatings. Some of them do suffer tremendous psychological torture. They take pictures of this. And what's believed is that they take those pictures to Bishop Alvarez and they say, these are your priests, these are your seminarians, these are lay people in your diocese who are suffering because of you. Just renounce the gospel on it. Swear your allegiance to our thuggish dictatorship and all of this can be over. Could you imagine for a father, the father of a diocese, a man entrusted with the salvation of the souls of his priests and of his seminarians, of his lay people, being told, these people are suffering because of your intransigence? Can you imagine the kind of torture of the heart that would be? Can you imagine the kind of faith required to say, no, our commitment to Christ is more. My commitment to Christ is more. I'm not responsible for this horrendous torture you're inflicting on other people, but I am responsible to be faithful to Christ and his church. Bishop Alvarez is faithful. It's an extraordinary act of courage. And again, this isn't the fourth century. They're using Facebook, just like my mom in 2008, but this is now. They're using Facebook, right? They're live streaming these things. They're texting each other. These guys, you can talk to them on WhatsApp if you know their numbers, right? This is right now. These people are suffering extraordinary torture for the church. So eventually, after months and months of this, there's this one beautiful story that one of these guys told our correspondent, where one of the people in prison was allowed to have visitors, and it seems that he was allowed to have visitors because they wanted to torture him by saying like that he was missing his family a great deal, so they wanted to give him just a couple of minutes with his family so that he would feel it all the more acutely, how homesick he was, how anguished he was. So he was allowed to visit with his sister and a couple of other relatives for a couple of minutes. His sister, tucked into a napkin, brought to him the Blessed Sacrament. She made some kind of distraction. She went into a coughing fit or something like that. She passed him the napkin across the table, and she said, take and eat. And he opened the napkin, and he received Holy Communion. And when he got back to the cell, he told everybody what had happened. And everybody else fell to their knees and prayed in thanksgiving because they felt that the Eucharistic presence was there among them and their brother who had just received Holy Communion. And for them, they said that was a consolation for weeks. God had given them the Blessed Sacrament in their midst. So eventually the Nicaraguans got tired of all this, and there's a lot of international pressure and ongoing media pressure, and these people weren't cracking. So the Nicaraguans at one point took all these prisoners and they put them on a bus. They took all their stuff, which was like some rosaries they'd made out of toilet paper and some other stuff. They took all their stuff away from them. They put them in clean uniforms. They put them on a bus. The windows of the bus were blacked out. They drove them to the airport. They put them on a plane. Each of them were dazed and confused, not the movie, but their experience. Each of them were dazed and confused, and they told them to sign a paper, which effectively was not a recantation, but an acceptance that their national status was going to be revoked. The government of Nicaragua decided the best thing to do was to strip them of their identity as Nicaraguans. And so they were stripped of their national identity, and they were put on a plane, and they were exiled to the United States. Now the priests are in different dioceses of the United States. The lay people are finding their way. They're all processing this extraordinary experience. Bishop Alvarez was given a chance to get on that plane too. The Nicaraguan government came to Bishop Alvarez and they said, look, they gave him this mock trial first. He had this really short trial. A criminal trial for something like sedition should take a little while. You should be able to have like a lawyer and witnesses and stuff like that. He didn't exactly have that, but they gave him a kind of mock trial. They brought him to a courtyard and they said, "You're charged with sedition and crimes against the state. How do you plead?" And he said, "Not guilty." And they said, "Oh, that's so funny, because you're guilty." And and so they sentenced him to 26 years in prison. Now, this guy's in his 50s. I think he's 58 or something like that. He's in his 50s. He's sentenced to 26 years in prison. I told you about the food. I told you about the conditions. You're sentenced to a sentence like that, that's a death sentence, and you know it. He's already losing an extraordinary amount of weight. He was not doing well. And they told him, "You've been given this sentence, this 26-year sentence to prison. We know it's a death sentence. You know it's a death sentence. Or you can get on this plane to the United States. And all you have to do is just stop talking. Stop proclaiming the gospel. Stop telling these dirty people who you seem to love that they have dignity because Christ loves them." And Bishop Alvarez said, "No, thank you. This is my country and this is my church. I'll stay here with my people." He wanted to go to prison because he wanted to hear the confessions of people who had been denied a chaplain. He wanted to hold out hope that someday in prison he might be able to celebrate the holy sacrifice of the Mass for his diocese. God had called him to be the Bishop of Matagalpa. He didn't want to give up on that. Now, if he'd gone to the United States, look, not only would it have been more comfortable, but he could have gone to the White House and asked President Biden to intervene. He could have gone to the UN and given a speech about the persecution of religious people and poor people in Nicaragua. He could have gone to the Holy See and asked the Holy Father to do everything that he could to address and remedy these things. But Bishop Alvarez wanted to stay in Nicaragua with his people. And he believed that that suffering was redemptive. He believed, he had to have made a judgment, he had to think through this, and he believed that that suffering was the means by which his people would experience sanctification, by the means by which his people would experience consolation, the means by which his people would experience holiness. Guys, everywhere I go in the United States, people tell me that the church is in a crisis, and all I think is that we are privileged to live in a time of extraordinary holiness. I thank God for the witness of Bishop Alvarez every single day. I thank God for the witness of Father Aki every single day. I could tell you more stories, but I'm only supposed to talk for a little while. But you can think of them in your own life, too. The church is the communion of the baptized. The church is the communion of the baptized. A communion of faith, sacraments, and governance. Right? The church, that communion has specific contours and a specific identity and ecclesial identity, but the church is the communion of the baptized. So when I say this, I'm not saying it, that's not sort of, when I say this, I'm not saying it in a felt banner way, a kind of we are the world way. We are the church. In our baptism, in the profound mystery of our baptism, we are incorporated into the person of Christ. And we are called with equal responsibility to our bishop, to our pastors, with equal responsibility to the Holy Father, to ensure that the gospel is proclaimed always and everywhere, that all people might know the saving message of Jesus Christ, that God might be rendered fit worship, that we might care for widows and orphans. Right? What does St. James say? This is true religion, to care for widows and orphans and to keep oneself undefiled from the world. All of us have that call. All of us have that commitment. And so the witnesses that you can think of extraordinary holiness in your own lives, probably people in this room, that's the story of the church. And if you think at all about the history of the church, you realize how myopic it is to focus on the problems. Newman says that history is an extraordinary consolation, because Newman says every generation makes the same mistake. Every generation is so self-important and so self-involved as to think that its ecclesiastical problems, its particular debates, its particular Christological or moral or Trinitarian heresies are so profound that this will be the end of the church. He says the cause of Christ is ever expiring from the face of the earth. He says Christians make the mistake of thinking that every century is worse than the last. Right? But Newman says the lesson of history is that the church endures. And the profound endurance of the church is found in the continuity of the sacraments and the way they're manifested in the extraordinary holiness of believers. If we want to know what the church in 2100 will look like or 2200 will look like, we have to think about what the spiritual significance of Father Isaac Aki's martyrdom will be. We have to think about the profound grace of Bishop Alvarez's sacrifice. Because Christ is working through those things to sow seeds in this generation that will bear fruit in the generations to come. And our call as Christians is to be in solidarity with those who are called to that kind of suffering, and to examine our lives to consider whether or not we're attaching equal importance to the proclamation of the gospel that they are. Look, we don't live in northeastern Nigeria. Boko Haram is probably not going to break into your dorm room tonight. And in a certain way, you might think, yeah, but if they did, I know exactly what I would say. Right? I know exactly what I would do. I think Father Isaac Aki only knew exactly what he would do in that particular moment because he had lived the life of grace, the pursuit of virtue, a desire for holiness in all of the moments which led up to that one. Why? Because there are plenty of people who apostatize, right? There are plenty of people who would apostatize. There are plenty of collaborators in the church in Nicaragua. They're going to be mad at me that I said that, but it's true. The history of the church behind the Iron Curtain is a history of saints and sinners, of resistance and collaboration. And if we're called to some kind of extraordinary act of witness, we're only going to rise to that call because we've pursued virtue in all of the individual moments which lead up to it, right? We've taken up the little bits of self-denial which come before that. Now, maybe God would give us an extraordinary grace. Maybe we would have some particular grace which we can't anticipate. But God ordinarily works for us to grow in holiness through our ordinary mortifications and penances and spiritual practice and interior life. And so our call is to live our lives with the same seriousness of purpose, the same seriousness of the proclamation of the gospel that these extraordinary martyrs of this moment live, and to ask God minute by minute and day by day how he's calling us to go forward. And Newman says it's a particularly perverse trick of the evil one to make us think that the kind of minute and immediate crises of the church are more important than that call to holiness. He says this, and this is what I want to leave you with. No, I can't because I left that paper over there. But he says this. No, I don't even get it. I know what he says. It wasn't that one either. It was someone over there that I dropped. No, it was this one. He says this. No, it's totally fine. Don't worry about it. He says, I kind of know it, and I'm paraphrasing. If you guys want to like say, like, he actually got it wrong. Fine, I actually got it wrong. He says this more or less. He says, look, the waves grow higher, the seas rage. Christ is in the boat, and the Lord who dwelleth on high is mightier than the storm. Guys, the Lord who dwelleth on high is mightier than the storm. And the great consolation and my encouragement to you is that the closer we are to him, the more closely we endure the storms, and the closer we grow in intimacy with God the Father. Thanks very much for having me. I'm very grateful to be here.